Some of the ones that the output is basically 1.6 times 10^19.2 volts. Now, the reason it's higher than your 12 volts you want for your car battery is to charge an electric battery, you need about 14.7 volts is the maximum amount to charge the battery. And then because you're going to get cloudy conditions, you want to always get 14.7, so they actually rated a bit higher than that. So under almost all conditions, you should get enough voltage out of your panel to charge your batteries. So that's what the commercial ones are built for. The unfortunate thing about them is that because you've got a whole bunch of things in series, the output of the whole panel is actually pretty much the lowest common denominator. So if you've got one cell that's not performing very well, it acts as a resistor. It doesn't actually become, it's not a conductor anymore, it becomes a resistor, and all of the energy from the other cells gets largely dumped into that one cell. And what we found when we did some tests is putting our hand in front of one cell and covering it, the actual output of the entire panel dropped by 60% just from covering that one cell. Now the solution to that in the car is that people bypass diodes in along the way so that any cells that aren't performing, the few around it will be dropped out of the thing and the power will turn to most of what it was putting out before. Which is a concern when you're building the cars. Some of the teams leave out the bypass diodes and they're very careful to basically turn the arrays off if ever the car had any shadow on the array. The problem, of course, being you've got like 200 cells in a big long line, you cover one of the cells, and then about a minute or two, they absorb so much energy they actually sort of destroy themselves and break your own string, which is not so good. Most cars actually construct their solar array by building a number of small panels, be they this big or this big or whatever size, and then physically attaching them onto the outside of the car somehow. We've actually built panels this size. Well, there's more at the very end of the presentation, the way she went through to build that, but that's one of the things that'll actually be on the car when you run the race. The maximum size of our car is 5 meters by 1.8 meters, which means that in theory, we could fit, if we fit them in perfectly, because they're about 10 centimeters square, 900 cells onto the car. The total voltage output by that would be about 540 volts. So the highest voltage we could achieve, if we had perfect coverage of our surface area in solar cells, is about 540 volts. Now, because that's much higher than we probably want to have, because most motors tend to run at 48 or 120 volts, we can basically divide that into a number of strings to get to a lower voltage, and then you have to come to the decision about whether you actually want to have the strings generating about your battery voltage, or higher than your battery voltage, or less than your battery voltage. And the... what's wrong? The wrong weather on there. I did that last night. The NPPTs are these called maximum power point trackers. They actually convert your string voltage to your battery voltage, and they take care of the... they can tell what charge state the battery is currently at by looking at the actual voltage, and then they give you the right voltage to charge the battery at your optimum rate. So they'll actually give you the right number of volts to charge when the battery's low. As the battery gets more full, it drops the volts off, and then will sit at the right thing when the thing's full to stop actually overcharging the batteries. They come in two different kinds. There's a convert, or three different kinds. There's a convert up. So basically, it takes a low string voltage, converts it to a high battery voltage. The opposite of that, so basically you've got a 48 volt system, 120 volts in your strings, it'll drop it down. And then they've got other ones that convert in both directions, but when they convert both directions, they tend to be less efficient because they've got to be able to deal with multiple situations. The problem is they're also rated to a certain number of amps. And with our particular situation of having like potentially about 500 volts of total to play with, we needed to have 150 volts for our battery voltage. 10 car batteries, if we've got a 120 volt motor, you divide it by two, the number of amps coming out of the strings is actually too high, and you couldn't fit it in the number of the two power point trackers, so therefore you needed to go to a lower one and use more trackers in parallel to convert the number of amps we're going to get out of our strings. Most of the teams actually use permanent magnet brushless DC motors. They come in two different varieties. It's just a standalone motor run by a normal drivetrain to the actual wheels, but most of the teams now are switching to use a hub motor. They've actually built the electric motor as the hub of a wheel, and the tyre sits on the outside of the motor, and you basically just drive that directly from the car. So you don't have a drivetrain between the motor and the wheel. It simply is the motor, is the wheel, and you actually lose, you basically get back about the 5 to 10% drivetrain losses you get with a chain or a belt drive going to the wheels. The problem is they're quite expensive, so they're not necessarily practical for a team like us. We're actually doing this on a very small budget compared to a lot of the other teams. the team that won the last World Solar Challenge is actually based out of Melbourne, and their budget for the race is like $3.5-4.5 million, but you can build their car and go in the race. If you look at the total cost of ours, building the car and competing in the race, we're probably looking at about $80,000, about half to build the car and half the actual logistics of going in the race, getting people to Darwin, to Adelaide, back, feeding, moving, that kind of thing. The motors for the cars, ours is about a 3.5 kilowatt motor. Some of the teams have motors about 8 kilowatts. The solar arrays on the cars will give you somewhere between sort of 1 kilowatt on the small cars through to about 2.5 kilowatts on the cars that have big budgets and buy really good cells. The 8 kilowatt motor, you can't run that permanently, but if you need to go at a high speed, you can tap into your batteries and travel at the higher speed while you're running off the batteries, and then basically slow down and let it recharge. So having an 8 kilowatt motor isn't necessarily a big help, it's just going to weigh more and you're not going to be able to use it all the time anyway. When we first started building the car, we had this huge dilemma of how we were actually going to work out what way we wanted to have the batteries, the solar array, and the motor. What it basically comes down to is your motor voltage determines what the battery voltage will be, so that tells you what batteries you need to have. The way you lay your arrays out determines what the actual voltages coming out of your array are, because you're going to have multiple streams putting out some voltage. And the maximum power point trackers have a voltage and an amp limit, so you've got to basically lay the strings out so you can do the right conversion in the right direction and still actually get your target voltage with the right power point trackers. Essentially, you can't do anything without knowing what voltage the battery is and consequently the motor voltage. So we had to actually pick a motor before we could do anything else. After much digging around, we eventually got hold of a second-hand motor from one of the other solar power teams who wasn't racing anymore. It's a Lumiton T-Flux motor. It's a brushless DC permanent magnet motor. It puts out about 3.5 kilowatts peak and 2.5 kilowatts sustain, and it runs at 120 volts DC, which is more than enough to hurt yourself, so we've got to be very careful. Once we decided the motor, we basically start building the actual chassis of the car. Now, I can appreciate, some of you probably actually know the stuff I'm talking about, but this is like part of your studies, but yeah, deal with it. The option for the car is basically a space frame. So you build a space frame, then put an external shell, usually made out of fiberglass or carbon fiber on the outside of it. The teams with better budgets or more engineering expertise build monocoque designs. Essentially, the composite materials they use to build the external shell of the body, actually, they also just reinforce the internal part of the structure, and that becomes the rigidity of the vehicle itself. So rather than having a steel chassis inside with a fiberglass on the outside, you just have like a carbon fiber shell with carbon fiber ribs inside, and it's stiff enough on its own to actually support the actual requirements of the vehicle, like suspension and stuff like that. To design the chassis, you need to work out how much space the driver was going to take, because it's all going to be built around the driver sitting inside the car somewhere. So we, you see the picture there, it's not very clear, it's very far back, but we actually built a little sort of bit of just, you know, simple to fabricate piece of dowel, a few bolts, and sat someone inside it, and sort of some cushions in the right space to sort of shape the figure they'd be sitting, then sort of netted them to work out how high they're going to be off the ground, how big the chassis needed to be, whether they fit, and whether they could get in this bar across the middle, because the suspension had to be there somewhere. We wanted to make sure the suspension wasn't going to collapse the thing on top of the driver whenever it first bumped. And it was a useful exercise because we discovered that no, you couldn't actually get in and out with that bar across the middle, so we had to come up with some other solution for getting the driver in and out without, or basically having that bar somewhere else so that this car was strong enough. To build a space frame, you identify all of the points on the chassis where there are loads coming in. You have the suspension loads coming in, you have the weight of the batteries sitting on the chassis somewhere, the driver's weight, the weight of the top shell. So once you know all these loads, under all the conditions, like when you get a bump, you know that you're going to get more load and suspension, so you might sort of double the weight of the car on there when you get a bump. So you've got all the points in three dimensions about space. You join some of the 3D dots together, so you think, oh, I'll have a line here, a line here, and a line here. And now you've got a whole bunch of vectors and points, and under the loads you're expecting to receive, you can actually calculate how strong each of those things needs to be, because you've got these points, they're only in tension and compression. They'll never actually get sideways loads on them because you've accurately measured where all the loads are coming in. You're not going to mount anything halfway along one of these lines. Once you've done that, the you can sit there and calculate how thick those things need to be. And that actually, there's a really good book done by the University of New South Wales about the 1996 World Toilet Challenge, where they went and basically captured all the learnings from the event. And they were talking about, with doing space frames for your chassis, that you could actually increase the size of the actual tubing you're using, and at the same time decrease the thickness of the tubing, and you actually get a very similar effect to like an aluminium can. And basically, you could build your car out of like aluminium can thickness material, and it would be okay with the risk being, if you didn't pick it up, you might actually crush the outside of it, in which case you might not have to really space frame after that. The golden rules basically is, once you've actually built the space frame, you only ever apply the load at the points you calculated. You never go into, I'll just weld something on the side here, and so I'll just put sort of something sitting on top of one of the members, because they're not designed to actually support loads in the middle of the members of the space frame. The our team basically, well, we haven't had a couple of people who've got engineering backgrounds, so I adopted a little bit with things like this, but we pretty much over-mentioned in our car, because we don't know for sure what the thickness of these things is, and so we've gone for the basically the very safe approach in every opportunity, and the car is over-engineered, we hope. We also need to think what configuration the car was going to be. That was actually quite an involved debate, including like sort of, should we have rear wheel steering, four wheels, three wheels, a number of other sort of issues. The basic design goals are, you want to have an even weight on each wheel, so you don't actually end up in a situation where the rear wheel supporting like, you know, sort of half of the weight, and the two front wheels have a quarter of the weight each, because then you've got to have a bigger rear wheel, and sort of this complicates matters. The other constraint we had there is that the there's a special brand of tyre made by Michelin, it's the Solar Car Radial. Now, we haven't actually ended up using them anyway, but in order to be able to use them, we had to make sure we used 16 by 2.15 inch rims. And so that actually constrained us to finding wheels that actually supported that particular size tyre. And we didn't want to then go and have a bigger one at the back, because it wouldn't have been able to support the extra, have that tyre on it with the extra weight loading. Unfortunately, those tyres are only rated about 100 kilos each, and our car's going to weigh more than three times 100 kilos, so we can't use them at the moment anyway. Basically, we've gone for a fairly common design, which is two front wheels that do the steering and one rear wheel that has the drive attached to it. That's what we ended up with. This, at the point where the photo was taken, there was no steering stuff in there. The brakes were partially complete. We actually had front calipers on there for disc brakes. The rear drum brake was actually connected and working, and has battery box holders and somewhere to mount the array. The array ended up being one big piece on the top of the car, but it needs something to sit on, because we didn't know at the time whether it was going to be stiff enough to support its own weight at the back, so we had to build a little thing at the back for it to sit on when it was actually mounted on the car. Next came suspension. The suspension came before that picture, but the picture was appropriate to put in there. There are approximately 102 cattle grids between Darwin and Adelaide. The cattle grids consist of a 10 centimetre gap, 10 centimetre piece of steel, 10 centimetre gap, and so on for about a metre and a half. Cars that have used like bicycle components or other systems without suspension have basically shaken themselves to pieces and had to drop out of the race, because they simply weren't equipped to deal with the vibration caused by going over those cattle grids at whatever speed they were travelling. And a successful suspension design basically will let you deal with potholes, bumps and things while you're going around corners or going in a straight line, and you'll continue to head in the direction you intend to head rather than sort of veering off to the side or making squealing noises every time you go over a bump. A lot of the common ways of doing suspension are actually quite heavy. Leaf springs, people suggested to us, have been a really easy way of doing it, but you've got to look how long, but basically that's the big long strips of steel on an angle, and they look really, really heavy, and one of the things we need for the car is to be quite light, because every time you add a kilo to the car, you're increasing the difficulty of going up a hill, and also your rolling resistance as you're rolling down the road. Double wishbone suspension has been put into a lot of solar cars. It seems quite successful, and so we chose to go with that. The basic principle of double wishbone suspension is you have a shock absorber, and then you've got two wishbones. The next slide tells you what the actual bits do, but you can see here, we've got the top wishbone, is this piece here. The shock absorber is that piece, and this is the bottom wishbone there. The wishbones are essentially just a rigid something that'll hold a point out here at a certain place, and then the points here on the side of the car, and give you a sort of a nice fixed rotation like that. Want to hand that around? You've all seen these things before. Hand it around if you want. The interesting about it, that it's not really necessarily apparent when you first start, because we didn't know it, that's for sure, is that the shock absorber is actually what supports the weight of the car. The wishbones don't actually have to support any real load in an up-down direction. So the car might weigh, like a normal conventional car, might weigh 1,000 kilos. But the wishbones don't need to be strong enough to hold 1,000 kilos of weight, because all they're doing is holding the wheel in the right place. The wishbones basically move up and down and move the wheel in the correct plane as you're going over bumps or into potholes. And they can, in fact, be designed relatively lightweight. Because the actual wishbones themselves are only working up, down, and then when you put the brakes on, the wheel tries to turn like that, so they're basically acting, one side's a tension, that side's a compression, but again, it's in a straight line, so you can get away with having quite thin tube for your wishbones. That one is over-engineered, so solid steel rods, because it was easier for us to manufacture that way. It's actually the shock absorber that holds the weight of the car, and the wishbones are merely holding the shock absorber and the wheel in the right place. And of course, you want your suspension to rest midway when it's actually built, so that if you go over a pothole, the wheel can go down rather than sort of only be able to go up. The other thing that's interesting is like all about why shopping trolleys don't do the right things, it's about caster angle, which is other things. It's actually quite distressing how much there was to learn about steering and suspension alone just to build this car, and it's not that complicated, but there's a lot to actually come to grips with. The caster angle helps your car self-center while you're driving down the road. Basically, it's not a very good color, is it? Much easier to see on this screen. Your wheel actually will rotate around some axis. Basically, design it so that it's got preferably an angle on it. Then when the wheel rotates, basically it's pivoting sort of like that around a point. When that pivoting happens, you actually want it to be pivoting on an angle so that if you extend the line of the rotation down to the ground, that the actual contact point of the wheel with the ground is behind the point where you extended that line of the rotation down. If it's not, what will happen is as you're driving down the road, the contact point of the wheel will try and move itself to behind the point of that rotation. And that will mean the steering wheel will just go one way or the other, which is not very helpful as you're driving down the road. If you have it like this, the contact point of the wheel is trying to drag itself to behind the center of rotation, which is hopefully going to be straight ahead. So when you're driving down the road, the car will automatically try and center itself, and that's all based on the caster angle, which is one of the interesting things we learned. You sort of now understand why you see people who build their own hill carts and they're driving down the road and the death wobbles up as they're going down the road like this. So that's because they haven't actually taken this into account. They build it with the actual center of rotation being directly above the contact point of the wheel. So don't do that. The rear suspension is far simpler. We've actually just got a swing arm that's hinged at the front, has the wheel mounted in the middle of it at the back, and then the motor's actually mounted in the swing arm as well. And you'll note that in this picture here, the shock absorbers aren't actually installed. There's a very stiff, there'll be a piece of a steel bar there as the dead pin at the moment. So we've actually put real shock absorbers in now, but that was the best photo we had of the rear swing arm. It seemed more appropriate to give you that one rather than the one from above that had the shock absorbers, but it couldn't see anything. Our motor pivots with the wheel, so unlike a motorcycle, we don't have to actually worry about having slack in the chain. The chain can basically tension to the right amount so that it's actually in the right spot. And when it goes up and down, the whole thing goes up and down together. Steering was next, after suspension. The goal of the steering system are to steer the car, provide the driver with sufficient leverage to turn the wheels when they actually need to turn the wheels. If you had it with a very stiff steering, you turn the wheels this far and the whole wheel's turn, but you've got a very, very large amount of force to actually overcome to actually turn the steering wheel, so you want a bit of leverage there to let the driver be able to turn the steering wheel when they need to, and also to stop the wheels from scuffing as the car turns. None of those are like car parks in the city, the multi-story ones, you've got concrete floors, as you're going around corners, the wheels squeal. That's basically because the steering isn't perfect in the actual angles that puts the wheels of the car, and one of them starts scuffing as you go around the corner. In this picture here, over about here somewhere, is the centre of a circle that the car is turning around. And there's basically concentric circles there for each of the wheel tracks the wheels should be following. Now, that's not a very good photo, because I took the circles away and straightened the boxes up, and it's like the wheels weren't exactly in the right sort of shape, like they were very sort of shifted over that way quite a lot. But essentially what you can see is that the wheel on the left-hand side is actually on a bit more of an angle than the one on the right-hand side. So for the car to go around the corner successfully, the inside wheel has to turn more to track around that right circle to go around a single point. Now, the magic is, there's a thing called Ackermann steering angles, I think it's called, and if you've got the wheels are in this location, and that's the point the wheels rotate around. So basically the wheel sort of pivots around that point there. Then all you do is you simply draw a line from these points where it rotates to the center of the back wheel where the back wheel contacts on the road, and then you attach the thing that steers the wheel somewhere on that line. And through the magic of just the way the angles happen to work out, it actually will pretty much give you the right angle for the wheels to go around the corner and give you the right angles to actually travel in that circle. It's just one of the magic of steering things. We read it in a book and we tried it and it seems to have worked, so we're quite happy. This is the actual steering that's on the car. You can sort of see it sticking up there. We actually ended up using a boat steering wheel mechanism, which is this silver thing on the back here of the steering wheel. And it's got a flexible cable that then runs down to the bar that runs across the car to steer the wheels. The advantage of this was we had to be able to get the driver in and out of the car, and we'd already determined we couldn't do that if there was a bar across the front of them. So we ended up getting this because the flexible cables are designed to be able to wrap through a boat and give you some sort of chance of putting where you need to go. And so again, basically that one there lets you fold it up out of the way, fold it down. It may not have a very long lifespan in its way it's installed there, but it should be more than enough for us to do the race and do our testing and still be able to get the car around safely. We had to just get a special cable made because the shortest ones the boat people actually made by default was like 1.8 metres or something like that, which is a bit longer than we actually needed. Maybe 2.5 metres. That one's about it's less than a metre. Probably all recognise that larrikin there. We issued the car out just as a chassis and did some driving around a car park just to confirm that it really did move around. The car drove quite fine. It got up to 40 kilometres an hour, which is our speed we must maintain in order to finish the race in time. And the only concerns we had was the motor got quite hot and started making a sort of a plasticky smell, which we think was just some paint burning off it, so it wasn't that big a concern in the end. But it worried us at the time, so we stopped driving the car. The car worked pretty well. I think the consensus of the day was that it actually got around quite happily and did what it needed to do. We still had concerns about how much power it was using doing that because we didn't have accurate current measurement. We had like a car amp meter, and basically you went from zero, you could sort of see 0, 15, 30, and 45 amps, and you could sort of see we've got about half of a 15 there. So that's, so we're using quite a lot, but we don't know exactly how much. Our budget for driving the car is we need to be able to drive about 10 amps or less. That's what we get. We're getting about a kilowatt in from our solar array, which means we can put about a kilowatt out, 120 volts, puts us around 10 amps somewhere that we can sustain. When you're driving down the road, you're putting a certain amount of energy in. That energy is going to a few places. One of them is when you're going uphill, you're actually adding energy to go up the hill. So your potential energy is one of the places your energy comes and goes. At about 60 kilometres an hour, which is the speed we hope to be travelling at, optimistically, the car is using about 50% of its energy overcoming aerodynamic drag and the other 50% overcoming rolling resistance. The rolling resistance is relatively proportional to your weight. You get some from wheel hysteresis, so basically when you're driving on the road, the wheels deform as they go sort of the flat bit when you hit the road, so you're actually bending the rubber, and that rubber essentially is coming out of you, causing the car to move. You've got to add the energy to do that. Drivetrain losses, bearing losses, and then if you've got poor alignment in the wheels, like you're driving on the road, your wheels pointing like this, you're actually scuffing the wheels the entire way as well. So not only are you wearing your tires out, you're actually it's costing you energy to do that. And largely, most of these things are based on your weight. So if you increase the weight of the car, the rolling resistance will get higher. The aerodynamic drag is the other half of the drag where you're traveling along 60 kilometres an hour. And essentially it's the amount of energy you're expending to push the air out of the way around the car as you travel through it. The aerodynamic drag, as you probably all know from like planes and things, increases exponentially with your speed. So the total drag for your aerodynamics is based largely, the main things are your surface area, your frontal profile, your front profile, like the extra shape that you've got a big sort of blocky thing or a skinny thing, and then your side profile. So if you've got sort of the air sort of flowing smoothly up and down, you're going to have a better thing if you've got sort of the big sort of square things like that in the middle of the road. And another one that affects you a little bit is the distance from the ground. In order to reduce your drag while you're driving down the road, the one of the trade-offs you can make is by adding an aerodynamic shaped body onto the outside of the car, you're increasing your rolling resistance because you're adding weight to the car, so you're increasing all those losses due to the rolling resistance, but you're also probably going to reduce your aerodynamic resistance quite substantially. So if you do the sums and work it out, you actually get the number of watts you're adding on for the rolling resistance, the number of watts you're taking off for the aerodynamic resistance, and invariably it works out that it's worth putting an external body onto the car. Plus, if it helps the driver drive, it starts to rain, so they're probably really happy about that. For the basic aerodynamics, if you have air flowing over a perfectly flat surface, you've got drag, because the molecules right next to the actual surface of the object are not moving. They're just sitting stationary against the actual surface. The ones that are some distance away are travelling at whatever the ambient speed of the air around you is. And all the ones in between are travelling different layers of different speeds, and there's friction between those layers, and that's where the actual drag is coming from as you're driving along. If you have to actually push the air out of the way, because you're an object rather than just a flat plate, you're also creating high pressure areas above and below the car, and if you're close to the ground, you're actually going to be pushing the air between the ground and you, so you're actually compounding that effect. Some of the smaller cars have like ground clearances of this much, and the problem is that you end up creating a really high pressure area underneath, because you're trying to squeeze half the air from the car under this very small gap between you and the road. Now, it would make sense if you think, like, your rolling resistance is based on the weight of your car, so if you can actually lift the weight of the car off the road, you're actually going to decrease the rolling resistance, and yes, you do. But the problem is, you're actually lifting your car off the road, just taking energy as well, and so by having either the car close to the ground or a wing-type shape that's going to give you lift with your forward speed, you reduce the rolling resistance, but you're also requiring a certain amount of energy to perform that lifting. And there is a break-even point somewhere, but it's probably very, very little. Because any amount of lifting of a heavy vehicle is going to cost you more energy than the benefit you're going to get from the rolling resistance, particularly because it's aerodynamic resistance you're adding to, and that's on an exponential rather than a linear one for the rolling resistance. It sounded like a lecture. I really didn't want this to be the case. But the other one that is quite bad is you're taking the average sedan car. You've basically got this sort of classic car shape that sort of goes up with the driver that sits and then sort of down again. The problem is that when the air is travelling along the car, it really wants to sit on the side of the car, because otherwise it's going to create this sort of vacuum. When you actually have the back of the cabin area of a normal car, it sort of tends to drop off quite quickly, and the problem is the air can't move down fast enough, and that's where the term is separation. And the separation basically creates a vacuum in the area where the air couldn't follow the car, and you end up with a vacuum sitting like behind the cabin of the car. And that vacuum, of course, is trying to make everything near it move towards it. So the back of the car is trying to lift up a little bit, and the front of the car is trying to move backwards a little bit. So you're actually driving down the road, and you're using energy to create this vacuum that is in turn trying to suck you backwards. It's like it's costing you energy to suck yourself backwards. It's like, one of those like, sort of big, loose or double-edged sword. The advice is basically to avoid having sharp profile changes in your cross-section, so that when people doing the design of your car, do a nice smooth up and then smooth it down if you can. It's not always practical, but if you can, you'll reduce the problems. So that comes around to the shell, basically. We need to actually build a shell to reduce the drag of the car. This is not our car, unfortunately. This is one of those books I didn't even know what they're doing. They've built about three cars now, and they're getting quite good at it. The shell serves many purposes. It gives you somewhere to mount your solid cells. It's aerodynamic, hopefully. The provides protection for the driver from the elements and just from things coming down the road when they're coming along. And it gives you somewhere to put the stickers. So because being sponsors and that sort of thing, you've got to keep them happy somehow. And that's the spirit of Canberra from Lake Tuggeranong College in the ACT. They've been quite successful in the Australian solar car races in recent years. Basic composites. If you take a two-part epoxy mixed together, you get a little sort of lump of plastic at the end. It's actually sort of quite hard and rigid, but it's not that hard to break. If you sort of get a piece, you sort of feel that just snap. If you insert glass or carbon fiber or something into that plastic while it's setting, you can still break it, but to break it, you've actually got to break the strands of glass as well. So you've actually added a lot of tensile strength into the actual plastic, and it makes it much, much harder to break. And that's where the term composites comes from, using multiple materials to make up a finished product. Interestingly, the more glass you insert into the product, the stronger it becomes, because you've got to break more pieces of glass. The more resin, or like plastic part you add into the mix, the heavier your drop gets, and it doesn't get any stronger whatsoever, because the strength's actually in the fibrous material you're adding into the final product, not the actual plastic. The plastic's simply holding the shape. So you get this nice curvy shape with the glass in it, and the plastic's just holding the shape, and the glass is providing the strength that goes into the object. Now, to make a very strong, rigid object that's very light, bending an object requires you to make one side of the object longer than the other. Otherwise, it wouldn't bend. Because they're the same length, they're going to stay straight. So if you want to stretch the object, again, you can't see the picture here, but basically we've got, there's one along here, another one along there, and basically one side of the object at the bottom is longer than the other because you've got two parts in the arc, and it's just different lengths now. The further apart the surfaces are, the less the overall deflection for the object for a given force, because you've got a bigger distance, and when you actually do that, you don't get as much deflection in the object. If you insert a lightweight filler in between the layers, you actually end up with what they call a composite sandwich. And these are two pieces of the same stuff here. Just this one's got fibers off on the outside, this one hasn't. If you look at this one, basically it's fairly wobbly and floppy. And that's exactly the same stuff. It's on the inside of this one, but it's like very hard to bend. Now, this stuff is called the V-cell foam. The other thing that's commonly used is a product called Nomex is one of the brand names. So it's a honeycomb. It's basically sheets of aluminium or aramid fibers that are sort of patterned by that. They join together and get a sort of honeycomb pattern. They use that as the core material rather than this foam. But the difference between those is actually quite remarkable. If you try, you will break the hard one, but it's actually remarkably rigid compared to the original. To improve the quality of your job, you can use a process called vacuum bagging. Essentially, when you're putting these things together, to make sure that they actually set properly, you actually just put a vacuum on it after you actually put it all together. So you get the original substance, you put the fiberglass and the resin on, and you put it under a vacuum and suck it down to make sure it all sets hard against the other surfaces. The vacuum pump I've got is actually quite interesting. It's a little box about this big, and it's actually just a venturi. You pump compressed air in, and it creates a vacuum on the inlet side. So that's how we actually made this. That's actually the side of the car being vacuum bagged. It's about 4.5 meters long. And the problem with doing that is you've got to actually make a flat surface to make it against that's 4.5 meters long. So the logistics of actually building the frames or molds to make our stuff against has been more complicated than actually putting the fiberglass on the actual products. And this one here was vacuum bagged, so it works equally well for quite large things or relatively small things. That's actually an offcut from one of these panels. When we make these panels up, they're a bit oversized, and that's actually a piece from on the sides along here where I've cut it off after we make the panel. Making complex shapes is a little more different. The conventional process is you build what's called a plug. Now, a plug is essentially a life-size model of your finished product. So you take whatever materials you happen to be really good at working with. I was showing my flatmate this last night, so she could proofread it for me. She says, what do you mean you can use anything? So, well, Play-Doh. If you're actually really good with Play-Doh or clay, you could build a life-size model of the finished product using Play-Doh. And then you make the mold based on that. So essentially building a plug is use whatever technology is available to you to make a life-size model of your finished product however you can. What we've done is we've used MDF and plywood, and we've built a... It's not very good there, a bit dark. We cut out ribs of the MDF, we put a little bit of plywood on the outside of it to fill in the gaps. We then put a layer of fiberglass over the whole thing so that it is held together in the right place, otherwise when you pick it up, it deforms a bit and doesn't necessarily keep the right shape. Then comes the really boring bit, which is like most of the 100 or so hours I spent making this plug. So basically you apply filler. We use automotive filler, the stuff you use filling dents in cars. But if you apply a layer of that and you sand it back to the right shape, and you just apply another layer of filler, the dips and dents and sort of little holes. And so you just do this over and over and over. It just goes on forever. It's very messy too. When you're finally finished, and you think you've got the shape right, you get basically increasingly fine pieces of sandpaper and go through and just sand it smooth to the point where if you actually look here, you can see the reflections of the little bit here is the sky, that's the side of the house, and like that's the floor down there. But actually it actually gets to the point where it's shiny with the sandpaper. And I didn't know you could make things shiny using sandpaper before I started this. It was actually quite a revelation to me halfway through the process to work out, oh my god, look, you can make that shiny. It's like, wow, that's cool. And the sad bit is that once you actually do that first time, you'll suddenly see all the defects that you couldn't see before because it wasn't shiny. So down the bottom there, repeat until correct. Peter and I actually went to a sun race, which is a race from Adelaide to Sydney. We went along as officials just to learn what the whole solar car racing was about. And there was a guy there, he brought a car along from Melbourne they'd made, and it was immaculate. Like, the surfaces were perfectly smooth, and the quality of your finished product is as good as the quality of your plug. So that one there, you can sort of see little sort of, it's got little ripples in it, it's not quite right. To get the finished product superb, you've got to get that superb. And it's one of those things that we decided that wasn't worth spending any more time on. It was more important to get the thing made and keep going. So we opted for a few defects and carried on. You build the mold next, which is basically you take the plug that you've built, you coat it in a release agent. They often use PVA, it's a polyvinyl alcohol. You just paint it on, it evaporates with a very thin layer of plastic on the outside of your mold, or your plug. And then the theory is that when you try and pull the mold off, that'll give way and the thing will come off nice and easily. And that's us just trying to fit on the front of the car after the fiberglass people have made the mold for us. We decided we didn't want to actually make the mold ourselves because after spending all that time doing the plug, we didn't want to destroy it the first time we tried doing anything with it. So we figured we'd get them to do it for us and make sure we got a decent mold off it. The saddest part about the whole process is that's the plug sitting there, smashed to pieces on the bottom of the fiberglass factory because they couldn't actually get the mold off the plug because the sides weren't taped quite enough, so they had to destroy it to get it out. And so I spent like well over 100 hours building that, and there it is sitting in pieces on the floor. But we've got the mold, so it's okay because we can make another one out of fiberglass if we ever want another thing that shape. We can just make another one out of fiberglass and start from scratch. So it's a bit sad, but yeah, that's the way things go. That's our finished product. We actually have it cut in two pieces, so we attached one to the top of the car, the other one to the bottom half of the car. The top one will actually come off with a solar array, and the other part will stay on the car. As you can see, it looks the same shape as that thing I've been making, and it's relatively light compared to the other one as well. The plug actually would have been like probably 40 kilos or something like that when it was finished, because there was a lot of wood and MDF and automotive bog in there. That's the car, that's the best product we've got at the moment. It's not a particularly great one. We've actually done a bit more than that since. It's got a floor in there now, I'm not going to put any difference in the photo. And the front of the nose cone is going to go on the front of the car as well. So that's pretty much what the car looks like. There's going to be a canopy over the top with the driver sitting that's a nice round, like sort of snazzy shape and everything. And it just needs the solar cells put on top. We will be doing some testing of the car before we finish putting the solar cells on, because the last thing we want to discover is that when we hit 60 km an hour, the top flies off the car. And like, I mean, that won't hurt the driver, but it will hurt the solar cells that happen to be attached. So we'll be taking the car for some test drives in that state. And you can actually see on the right-hand side, there's all holes through the top of the car there. The panels here actually have contact points in the back where all the solar cells are soldered on together. And we need to be able to test that to make sure that the cells are working properly. So at the end of every day, someone will have the joyous job of sitting there with multi and just going and checking to make sure that every single one is working. I'm not looking forward to doing it myself, but we have to be able to have holes in the top of the car to be able to access those test points. We're now the proud owners of 1,000 solar cells. They're basically just like these ones here, 10 centimetres squared, and they're 16% efficient. They came from ASE in Germany. The finished solar array, with all of those panels intact, has approximately 5,000 solar connections in it. And they were all done by us, mainly by Pete's dad, actually. He was a real sucker. The final car actually has about 630 cells on it. There's about 20 of those panels, and then there's some other ones we managed to fit on the top of the canopy. And that comes to a total of about 1,000 watts. So we have about a kilowatt of power to run our car on. The comparison is basically that if you take one of the, like a large family car, they're about 150 kilowatts. So we're basically running about 1% of what a conventional family car runs on. And that's the process of making the cells into panels. This one here, you can see the bit here has the raw panel, which is just like that stuff we're handing around. It's got double-sided tape on there to hold the cells down, and we basically just feed the cells through the holes and basically stick it on. The double-sided tape, that was another bit of revelation of doing this. It's 3M VHV, which is very high bond strength tape, and they actually sell it to the automotive industry for putting trucks together. You actually, the sheeting that goes in the back half of trucks, rather than using ribbons to put it on, you actually put this double-sided tape on and just push the sheets on there, and that's what holds the trucks together. And it was really quite amazing. Peter was putting some on for a test when we first got it. He put one little strip down, put the side of one of our test cells onto it, and couldn't get it off. This is this little piece of tape like that, and we couldn't get the cell off without breaking it. We were actually quite impressed, and so we didn't think there was any problems about our cells coming off or driving down the road after that, that's for sure. The actual solar array itself is consists of about 23 of these panels. There's one that's got a special cutout bit on it for the candidates to get on too. We spent about 3 hours making every fiberglass panel, about an hour of prep, an hour of actually sort of putting the fiberglass on, then about an hour or so sort of cutting it up and other stuff afterwards. About an hour to drill it and put tape onto it, 4 hours to tab the solar cells and then put the solar cells onto the board, solder them together. Or the 1 hour, so attaching the solar cells on here. We're spending about nine or 10 hours this per panel making it. So basically we're looking at over 200 hours just actually making the solar panels to go onto the car, which was quite an undertaking. Add to all of this, fundraising, procurement. You'd be surprised how much time and effort goes into just trying to find things. Like the tie rod ends, the little sort of things, the spinny things on the end of the wishbone that got handed around. We spent sort of hours and hours and hours trying to find places that sold appropriate ones of those. Then when you find them, you find out they don't make the particular one you want in the metric size thread that you want. So you've got to start thinking, well, do I want to go for the imperial one or not? It's like endless pain, basically. Procurement takes far more time than you really appreciate. There's logistics of actually getting up to the race, interpreting the rules. Some of the rules are a bit vague, and you've got to go try and chase up with the race organisers, what does this actually mean? Can we do this? And that takes quite a bit of time. And it also holds you, because we wanted to make decisions about whether we could do certain things, and you can't actually keep building the car and do those things until you know whether your interpretation is correct. So you end up wasting time waiting for them to get back to you with answers to questions. Managing the team, there's all these people doing things for you. You've got to try and make sure people are actually being gainfully occupied with their time or whatever time they can do, and make sure the right people are doing the right things. The weather has been an issue. Like, we're going to walk over here today and you're going to drive the car up into the park because it poured with rain about midday. The weather's also been bad for doing fiberglass stuff. The stuff we have to do for the shell of the car is big, and we can't do it inside, so if it's raining, we pretty much can't do it outside either, and we've been stuck like that a couple of times. It's not really having appropriate facilities. And just find the time to fit it in with all the other things you have to do during the week. Has it been worth it? Well, we've learned a lot. I had a really good time. We've learned heaps, and it's been a very valuable experience as far as I'm concerned. It's been a pretty feel-good project. I mean, it's not about here sort of building a drag car or anything. Like, we're actually building a solar car to run off the power of the sun. It's like kind of cool. So that's been pretty good. And now it's time for questions and answers. I'm going to have a boy who did some questions.